Welcome to the NCO Journal's Sergeant's Time podcast, featuring informal conversations with leaders at all levels, where you'll have the unique chance to learn what makes them tick, what their leadership styles are, and what inspires them. I'm your host, Staff Sergeant Brandon Cox, NCOIC of the NCO Journal. With us is Chaga Zapata, the managing editor. Today, we welcome Command Sergeant Major Michael L. Spaulding to our podcast. Command Sergeant Major Spaulding assumed responsibilities as the interim Command Sergeant Major of Army University 9 September 2024. Sergeant Major Spaulding enlisted in the Army in 1991 as military intelligence. Some key assignments include executive assistant to the senior enlisted advisor to the chief of the National Guard Bureau, the Nevada State Command senior enlisted leader, senior enlisted advisor to the TRADOC's deputy commanding general, and more. Simultaneously, Sergeant Major became a successful business owner in information technology, real estate, and appliance industries. Sergeant Major Spaulding, it's an honor to have you on the show.
Well, it certainly is my honor. Thank you for having me here today.
Absolutely. I got to start off by asking, as we read through your bio, you know, you joined in 1991. That was right during Desert Storm. 33 years of service is quite a long time. I can't imagine the perspectives that you have, some of the wisdoms that you have, which I hope we'll dive into later. But what's given you the drive to stay in?
So I think that the best thing about being in the reserve component is that you have this ability to take a little bit of time off and at certain times in your career and focus on your family and then really get back into it. And I've been totally blessed with that. So unlike a lot of my Compo 1 counterparts, you jump into the job and you're going on the job, you know, whether it's private, a specialist, a sergeant, there's always this go, go, go. You're kind of always turned on. Whereas in my career, I've been able to slow that down a little bit. There's been times where it has by necessity been, you know, go absolutely high speed as fast as you can, get the most done that you can. But then those times are tempered with, you know, a year, 2 years where I'm really able to focus on my family. And I think probably the other thing is we have an opportunity to really spend time in one place where we're not moving the family around a lot. And I suppose that would play into it a little bit, but every single day, what drives me is that I get the opportunity to put the uniform on and talk to a little bit about, you know, these callings that we have in life. Maybe you have a calling to become clergy, or you have a calling to become a teacher or something like that. I think for us to put the uniform on, it really has to be a calling. You love putting the uniform on. You love wearing the cloth of your country. You love being able to go out and represent all of the great things that your country is all about. I suppose that's probably pretty true of all of the military folks I've met from several countries around the world. That's what gets me up in the morning is that I actually get an opportunity to put on that uniform and come and serve something that's much bigger than what I am.
Yeah, I'm with you. There's no greater feeling than, no matter what you think, at the end of the day, the next day you get to put that uniform on and go to work, and it just gives you a sense of pride, I think, that you don't get in civilian life.
I was wondering if I could dive into, maybe we should kind of take a step back. Let's start from the beginning. So where are you from? Tell us about where you're from. Tell us about, is that where you served in the, you said it was it initially in the reserves, right? So is that where you started your career? And then, you know, from your hometown, tell us about your past.
Yeah. So I grew up in Long Beach, California, spent, you know, my first, I suppose 18 years, 19 years there, and attended Lakewood High School. When I was, gosh, probably like maybe 10, 11 years old, I started reading these books on airplanes. My grandpa gave me this book. He was in World War II. He was on B-17s. And he gave me this book about airplanes, man. And I read that book from cover to cover. I couldn't stand reading, but I loved reading everything I could about airplanes. I loved it. And then 1986, Top Gun comes out. And man, look, I was going to be an F-14 pilot. There was no two ways about it, man. I was going to fly in Top Gun because that was just the coolest thing that there was. So I wanted to go be a pilot. I really wanted to fly and went, and I joined this program called Civil Air Patrol. And from the time I was, 13 through about 20, I was in Civil Air Patrol. I was in the cadet program. I got to fly. I got to solo at Long Beach Airport. I got to do a lot of really neat things. But that was this time where it really developed me as a leader. I started learning these things that really intrigued me. And I was, honestly, I was kind of the kid that was a little bit of a spaz. I see it in my son sometimes. I was a little bit of a spaz and not always, let's say, the most disciplined of children. So in Civil Air Patrol, I really learned about discipline, this self-discipline, how to lead other people, how to be an example for other people. When I was 15 years old, I had an opportunity to guest instruct at the 22nd Air Force Non-Commissioned Officer Leadership School at then Norton Air Force Base, California. And it really changed who I was. Here I was, 15 years old, standing up here in front of all of these adults, talking to them about these leadership concepts and getting into some really good conversations about these leadership concepts. And I loved doing that. I loved teaching. I loved sharing that knowledge because I realized, I think really young, it's not just for me to keep. If I just keep that knowledge inside and I don't share that knowledge with those around me and even further if I can, then it does me no good. I'm going to die one day and that's going to be that. There ended the knowledge. But really the impact along the way was, who did I get to share that with? And I suppose that kind of hit me, you know, in some younger years, so that as I grew up in the Army, I joined the Army Reserves, and I was actually was an ROTC cadet at Cal State Fullerton. I was in the simultaneous membership program, so I was in the 140th Military Intelligence Battalion out at Bell, California. Real exciting times, I suppose, looking back on it, it was pretty dull, but man, I get to go out in like cool Army equipment. I get to see some really cool stuff. Everything was just neat. It was fun, and I was always learning. We had the Rodney King riots in LA, so I had an opportunity to sit in the Coliseum with gunshots going off all around South Central LA. So I learned a little bit about domestic response. And as an Army reservist, Posse Comitatus was in play. And of course, I didn't get to carry any weapons. So there was no shooting back. Not that I probably would have, but you know, sometimes you feel really just naked. And there I was in the Coliseum feeling really just naked. It was kind of one of the worst feelings. In any case, because I was not the most academically inclined person at the time. Go back to not always the most disciplined person. My GPA led me out of college and onto kind of this other path. But I really enjoyed being in the Army. I thought several times maybe I'll just go active duty. I ended up joining the California Army National Guard as a tanker. They sent me off 1994. Sent me back to. An inject in one station unit training, which was kind of funny. What they really said was, hey, we're going to send you to AIT and it's only about 5 weeks. Don't worry about it. You'll be back. Life will be good. Yeah, that sounds awesome. Sign me up, coach. And what ended up happening was I showed up back there and they said, no, we're going to inject you in week two of OSIT. So you got 13 weeks left. So you can get out or you can stay here. So I stayed there, enjoyed every bit of it. At every step of the way, it was always like there was just this plan for me to just continue to serve.
So why not the Navy or, you know, the Air Force for that matter? I know Top Gun, he's a Navy pilot. So why did you choose the Army and not some other service?
Well, it was real competitive then to go be a pilot, right? Because, well, Top Gun, everybody wanted to be a pilot. Mm-hmm. And in the Air Force, I knew a lot of people who would, for the first 3-4 years, they would be flying a desk somewhere and then they would go to their undergraduate pilot training. So they weren't just putting you in and then sending you to go be a pilot. there was kind of this delayed start in a lot of those pilots. And I was like, all right, that's not for me. And of course I had to have my commission to go do that. And look, I mean, it is not in my nature. I don't want to go wrench on an aircraft. I am, I enjoy doing mechanical stuff, but, those folks that have that attention to detail, God bless them. That's just not this guy. What are the job are you going to do? Go stand on the deck of an aircraft carrier, or probably more likely I would have been on some, you know, frigate somewhere or what have you. And there I was doing a job that I really didn't enjoy. What I did enjoy was going out to the field. What I did enjoy was you know, racing around in a Humvee and in Civil Air Patrol. I got to go jump in a you know, Humvee and race around Fort Irwin with the squadron that was there. And we got to go do all these cool things. And I got to watch, you know, these big battles that were taking place out there. And I was like, man, this is just cool. So I kind of made this decision. My mom really hated it. I made this decision. Look, if I can't fly an airplane, maybe I'll go jump out of airplanes. In ROTC, I got to go jump out of airplanes. I absolutely loved it. And I thought, man, this is going to be me, Airborne Ranger. Yeah. National Guard tanker, kind of close, I suppose, but it was again just the path that apparently I was on.
Yeah.
A quick note about the LA riots. I was there too. I was stationed at Marine Corps Air Station El Toro,
mm-hmm.
and when Marines from Camp Pendleton came up, some infantry, I think it was an infantry company came, and they were in one of the hangars, and I actually went with them to, they were patrolling. I think it was Compton, to mm-hmm. be honest. I think that's yeah. where we were. There was nobody around when we were out there and you know, face shields and the plastic shields, and
right.
nobody wanted to mess with us. It was very quiet, but we were patrolling the street. I was, you know, I was at there at PAO taking pictures and doing my thing and, you know, walking with the Marines, but it was about the most boring thing. You could hear all kinds of action, things going on and smoke and all kinds of stuff going on in the world around sure. us. But we were in a little island of calm and solitude that just, maybe there was something that happened earlier, but, for the most part, it was kind of boring.
That's kind of a great place to be when everything's just nice and calm and chill yeah. and all of that stuff. Did you ever go do the Volkslauf?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah. So did that for a lot of years as a Civil Air Patrol cadet out at Tustin. Yeah. Loved it.
You know, looking at some of your personal hobbies here, Sergeant Major, you were talking about you like to do triathlons. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I came back from Afghanistan in 2009 and, you know, I'll tell you, it wasn't, my deployment wasn't like this horrible time. It wasn't like, you know, this action-packed, high stress, all this combat. I was in Afghanistan as an embedded training team member. I was a command sergeant major mentor for an infantry CANDAC. And there was enough that was going on. There was enough things that happened around us. By the time I got home, I didn't realize really the impacts that it had on me. With your reserve and National Guard folks, they come home. There's a little bit of a yellow ribbon program, and you know, you're gonna have this reintegration over a certain period of time, and then that's it. There you go, and it's gotten significantly better. But I remember one of the DPHs that was there talking to us, and thank goodness we had this incredible State Command Sergeant Major that was just real open. About his time coming back from Iraq and leading to divorce and all of this stuff. I knew that I needed to get my life squared away because it just felt out of control. And I knew that I needed to do something. I didn't quite know what to do. We had this conference there shortly thereafter in Las Vegas, and we had this guest speaker that came out. He was also a National Guardsman. He had deployed in 2005, 2006, and by the time he came back from deployment, he lost his wife. He had his kids. He was living in the basement of his parents' home, and every night he was hitting the bottom of a bottle trying to figure out what his life was going to be all about. He was working as an AGR, active guard and reservist, within his unit, but he was struggling and didn't know what to do. So we started talking about the four pillars, and I'd never heard about any of the pillars, much like our pillars in H2F. But he talked about spiritual, emotional, physical, and mental. And he talked about the importance of each of those in his life. And he's talked about the physical. For whatever reason, that really resonated with me. Man, I'm sitting here like I'm smoking cigarettes and I'm doing all this other crap and I'm probably drinking a little too much. I need to do something physically. Like I need to go out and do something. So I decided, man, hey, you know what? I'm going to go do triathlon. Somebody told me it was really hard. And I said, yep, sign me up. That's going to be me. So myself and a couple of my buddies, soldiers as well, we said, look, we're going to go do this triathlon thing. And we started. And day one, said, let's go to the YMCA. We're going to meet at this gym. We're going to go swim. That's what we're going to do. And we started swimming. And I think by the time we finished a lap, meaning just once down the pool, all of us wanted to vomit. We're like, what the heck are we doing, man? This is for the birds. We figured out the swimming bit, and I got through a 750-yard swim. That wasn't too bad. But it really, what I really loved about it was this community of people, regardless of who you are or what your background is, they want you to be a part of it. They're like, yeah, you're crazy enough to be a part of that with us? Come on in. I remember my very first triathlon, this lady, she comes out, she goes and sets her bike up, this mountain bike, and she was pretty darn heavy. She was pretty darn heavy. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my gosh, is she going to make it? Now she pedaled up this hill and I was sucking going up this hill. You know, it's about 12 miles. It was a sprint triathlon, about 12 miles up this hill. So I'm sucking getting up this hill. And I'm like, I'm thinking back to this poor lady, man. Like, oh my gosh, what is she going to do? Get off the bike and I go run my 5K and we come back and there's a beer truck that's there. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is totally my speed. Got a beer truck here. We're good. So sitting over there, carbon back up, you know, because that's the healthy thing that we do. I think maybe that's not an H2F, but yeah, in any case. So I see this lady get off the bike and she goes off on this run and everybody stops. She's dead last. Everybody kind of stopped. And this roar comes out of the crowd and everybody is cheering for this lady to go finish this run. And by the time she finished that run and comes running back to us, I mean, this is a while. It's probably like 40 minutes, right? You know, this roar has kind of reached this crescendo and every man, you know, beer is still coming out of the beer truck and everybody's having a good time and it is just getting louder and nobody is going home. Everybody is staying for this lady to finish and they're cheering for her. And these are some of the most fit people that you've ever seen in your life. They're cheering for her. And I thought, man, dude, this is like the coolest community in the world. Everybody is here to help change this lady's life. That was something I wanted to be a part of. And not only did they change that lady's life, but I'll tell you, that lady changed my life, changed how I saw myself. I'm running around here smoking cigarettes and you know, worrying about all this stuff. She's got all these other struggles that's going on. And here we are together at this triathlon, understanding everybody's got struggles. We're not really all that different. And I get to cheer her on and I get to see the smile on her face. And I remember her looking at me. She's probably just looking through the crowd, but I remember her looking at me. And it left this indelible mark that regardless of who you are or where it is that you come from, anything is achievable.
I love that story. Yeah, and I can relate to it because of an experience I've had in the Army, right? You know, you're on your 12-mile ruck or, you know, you're doing the confidence course and you got people cheering for you. But I've only experienced that in the Army. I never experienced that in civilian life. So I think that's really special that community has that same effect.
Yeah. I think that for most of the folks, they go, man, you're sick enough to try this because this is hard. Even doing like the short ones, this is hard. You overcome all your fears. Maybe that's a fear of swimming or just being out in front of people. Cause let's face it, man, when you put on a triathlon suit, it's a little revealing. Let's just say, you know, you're not wearing a lot, but it helps you to go fast.
Right. So before we move on to anything too crazy, I want to think back to the time that you were a young NCO. Can you tell us about a particular challenge that you faced and then how you handled it?
Yeah. When I was a corporal, I was the guy that would show up to drill, and I'd have, you know, the sideburns down to, you know, the lower opening of the ear, and yeah, they were squared off during, you know, because I was civilian otherwise. And so I'd let them grow out, but for drill, I'd trim them up just a little bit, and I would let my hair grow out, right? Let my hair grow out. And I was always right at the maximum, always pushing the limits. And I had this first sergeant, guy's name's Ron Morse. Man, this is a man that truly changed my life. I love this dude. We would jump on a bus, and we take a bus down to Fort Irwin, because that's our unit at the time was in 221 Cavalry, and we rounded out the still had the round out battalions. We rounded out the 11th ACR down there for doing Op 4. So we did all these Op 4 missions. So every one of our drills was go down to Fort Irwin. We drive down there on a Friday on a bus. We'd spend Friday through Sunday essentially doing 24-hour ops. We would turn around on Sunday and come back. And Ron, instead of sitting in front of the bus, you know, the commander and first sergeant would sit in front of the bus and they'd drive down the road because, you know, we're in charge, hands on the hips and all that stuff. Ron would come back and sit with people and find out all about the unit, what's going on in the unit. And he comes back and sits down with me one afternoon. And look, it's Sunday. I'm tired. I've been up now for probably 48 hours or so with maybe a couple of hours of sleep in there. And he starts having this conversation with me. Hey, you always push the limits. Hey, you always do this. Hey, and I said, man, I'm sick of the Army. You know, I really had one of these kind of FTA kind of attitudes. I was just done with anything. Commander was, our troop commander was great. Battalion commander had done some things I didn't care for. I was, you know, grumping and all that stuff. Look, I was getting out. And Ron sat and just had this really leader development one-on-one. And really changed how I see the Army. He sent me, he sent my packet forward for promotion, which I was PLDC at the time, complete. And he sent my packet forward for promotion, which that wasn't happening with previous leadership. And so I was going to be done. But Ron taking just a couple moments just to pour into this knucklehead that was always pushing the limits, that was always, you know, going to those ends. He changed really kind of, you know, how I see the Army, how I see leaders. Not everything is always going to be great. Not everything is going to go the way that I want it. But how do I be the best example for my folks that I can be? And Ron being back there as just one of us, having conversations with us. I took that as a first sergeant. I kind of used that same tool, some of those same tools all throughout, you know, being a leader. And I don't know, he's just always held a special place in my heart that he would actually take that time to really care enough to take care of this guy.
Isn't it strange how one, thing happens in your life that can change the entire trajectory of your life, where, you know, the right person at the right time at the right place says the right thing or does the right thing, and then there you are, and now here you are, Command Sergeant Major. Would you say that he is the leader who influenced your leadership style more than any other? Or is it more of a conglomeration of other NCOs or other leaders who've made an impression on you?
Well, I would definitely say it's a big conglomeration of people. And I would also say it's not only leaders. But Ron as a leader probably has had the biggest impact on me. That is for sure. But in order for me to become a better leader, I really had to, be able to accept feedback. And I wasn't always so good at that. And I had this, this kid, kind of a, maybe a little bit long story, but this guy, Ray Swanson, Ray was hands down one of the smartest people that I'd really ever met. And probably to this day have ever met. At 19 years old, regional manager for a clothing store. So at 19 years old, he's responsible for all of Southern California, all the stores that are in malls. And the company that he worked for was kind of a big name company. You would absolutely recognize it. So he's got all of Southern California, all of Southern Utah, all of Southern Nevada, and Arizona. And this guy is just running the show, taking care of everything. You know, he's got his numbers down. He's training managers that are probably twice his age. He's making all of this happen. Incredible to see. And in my formation, he's a PB2. The problem was he couldn't pass a PT test. So we get down to Fort Irwin. We mobilize. We go down to Fort Irwin. We're down there for a while. And I said, all right, man, I'm going to get this kid to pass this dang PT test. I'm going to motivate him to pass this PT test. So I did everything that I could to motivate him to pass this PT test. We're going to go to extra PT. We're going to do all of this stuff. I'm going to motivate this guy. Now, if we didn't call a 2-mile run a PT test, this kid can go out and run, you know, 16 minute 2 miles. It is no problem. It can run faster than that if you really wanted to. But once you called it a PT test, all of a sudden it was like 25, 26 minutes. He couldn't run to save his life. Total mental block. I'm like, it's mental. I've got this, you know? So I go high directional on him, right? You know, generally the knife edge and in berating him using some of these, you know, we'll call it older school motivation tactics, right? And in front of the formation, I'm going to get him to do what I need him to do. And he just stood there and took it, hands down, one of the smartest people I know. He just stood there and took it and said, okay. Well, later on that evening, I got all of my NCOs, come over and knock on my door. So I hear this. I'm like, I'm not expecting anybody. Hey, what's going on, guys? Yeah. Like, can we talk to you? Yeah, come on in. So they come in and essentially lay out to me how what I did was wrong, how screwed up I was, that anything that I was trying to do, I had the exact opposite effect on this young man. And that they were disappointed in me. And out of all of that, the being disappointed in me was probably what hurt the most. Now, of course, I had a couple opportunities there to you know, refute them. And they obviously, they just don't understand. But I think the reality was they understood better than I did about what that moment was really all about. And so I just think a lot that night about it, man, I really screwed this up. And I've got all these guys, not just that they're upset at me, but that they told me where I was wrong and I got to fix this. So the next morning at PT, I get everybody around. We're not going to go to really do the PT that I had planned. We're going to get everybody around. And I bring Ray up and I just talk to Ray and I apologize to him. And I apologize to everybody in the formation that I did this. I didn't come up with all the excuses about why it was that I did it or, you know, how important all these things were. I didn't do any of that. I just apologized to him. And two things kind of came out of it. Number one, all of my guys did probably a bazillion times better than I ever could have motivated them. And of course, Ray ended up passing his PT test shortly thereafter. And we were able to promote him to PFC, which is really what I wanted. Like this kid should have been a dang staff sergeant at the time. And here he was like as a PV2. I mean, he had the wherewithal to be a quality NCO. So I appreciated a couple of things. Number one, that they felt comfortable enough to come and tell me how screwed up I was. Number two, as I thought back on it a lot, we have to do more as leaders to create environments where our people want to provide that feedback for us. Sometimes we don't, unless we specifically open the door and ask for that feedback or pull that feedback, it's difficult to get that feedback. And believe me, as I've moved up to a lot of these different jobs, the higher you go, the less feedback you get because nobody's going to tell you you're wrong. As a matter of fact, they're going to tell you how great you are and the ideas that you have. They're incredible ideas and just how smart you are. You're going to hear all of these things, but how do you surround yourself with people like these guys that I had, you know, Phil Daniel and Tom Henry come in talking to me about me being screwed up? I think that it's moments like that helped shape my leadership style and the things that I really wanted to do. So yeah, I learned a lot from leaders, but I think I learned a lot more from these young leaders that helped to inspire me to be a better leader for them. I think that's kind of what we, when we talk about servant leadership, that's really what it is we're supposed to be getting after. How do we better serve them?
Would you say it would be because you empowered them?
If I empowered them, it was purely coincidental and by accident. I believe today everybody has the power to do things. We can do things well, or we can screw things up. As leaders, when we shut down that communication, I was just heard a story from one of my colleagues just a couple days ago about how brought something to the IG, and the IG at the time had allegedly, you know, shut him down, like, no, you're not, we're not going to discuss that, we're not going to look at that. You know, there's decisions that are made every day, that sometimes, you know, we have to look at what's important for us. Is it important for us to be right, or is it important for us to get the right thing done? There's a lot of humility that has to go with that, but we also have to sometimes force some issues that are very awkward for us that maybe career limiting, you know, in the traditional sense. People go, oh, you don't want to say that because that's going to be the end of your career. Why should it be? Why should speaking truth to power be the end of my career? And I'd say any leader that lets that be the end of a quality soldier's career because they're speaking truth to power, you're probably the person that needs to turn in your stripes, bars, eagle, whatever it is that you're wearing. You probably need to turn that in because you should not be a leader.
I think it all comes down to also you're walking this fine line, because you want to empower, or you want to be able to open to have somebody come and talk to you that way, but that could go in another way where you might be criticized, or it might affect your leadership. So there's always this fine line that you have to walk, and I think it's important that obviously I think you found that line, because it's like just here, you working here at Army University, you've made yourself very approachable, and somebody like Staff Sergeant Cox being able to go in and talk to you and being recognized not just as a soldier but as a human being, I think that all comes together and is all turns into one thing, I guess. And I think, but again, I think there's a fine line you have to walk, because I guess there's times that if you're too easy or too open, that it could affect good order and discipline. You can't be their buddy. You're their leader. So again, that fine line has to be, you have to kind of tread it carefully.
Yeah, I would maybe even suggest the line is not so fine, that there really there are some hard lines. To be able to sit down and talk with a person, that's easy enough. But everything is predicated upon trust, right? So if you have instilled this trust in your organization, whatever level it is that you're working at, in your organization trust you. We in Mission Command, we talk about mutual trust, and that's kind of like, yeah, duh. It should be trust. If you're going to lead them, they need to trust you. And inherently, you are trusting them to be the professionals that they are to get the job done. So just on that notion right there, if I am inherently trusting them to be the professionals that they are to get the job done, then we should be able to have a conversation. We should be able to have a very open conversation about, you know, that one time or whatever the case may be. And we can move on. We get so stuck in this, how am I going to be judged at the end of all this stuff? How am I going to be judged? And, you know, if somebody takes something wrong, you know, hey, look, I apologize. I don't want somebody to be offended. That's a fact. But if both of us get to grow out of that particular opportunity, hey, look, it's a win-win. Maybe I said something that upset somebody. Maybe I said something that was wrong. I'll take the feedback and we'll grow from it. But it's still predicated upon that trust. The spirit of what it was that we talked about was what was more important than necessarily sometimes the actual content, if that makes sense.
Kind of moving on just a little bit, we're going to transition to a little bit of your, you know, some of your initiatives, some of the things that you've experienced, especially being at some of the top levels of the National Guard and Army Reserve. trying to get some of your wisdom and knowledge. And I know first, I kind of wanted to ask you to get your philosophy on, you talked about it earlier, but balancing a life between two careers, civilian and army, and having a family, raising children. I think you had a philosophical three-legged stool that you spoke of. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a unique time being in the reserve component writ large, and you have these pulls at various different times in your career. As you join, man, you're really excited to do great things, and I get to be a soldier, but you know, I'm going to college and I'm starting this other career over here. So I've got two that are kind of pulling at me, balanced my time with my career, with my time over here in doing Army stuff, whether that's going to schools or even just being at drill or extended drills or times we have to come in early for a drill or battle assembly for the reserves. And they need people to help prepare and all of that. So you get to sometimes spend a little bit more time helping to do those things and get paid. But when you throw a family into the midst of all of that stuff, Army likes to talk about balance, and we have to balance all of these things. And I would propose that there's a fundamental flaw with this idea of balance, that somehow everything is going to be 50-50 across this balance. It's never going to be 50-50. Nothing is ever going to be in balance in your life, in true balance. Sometimes something is more important than another. So it really is about how do we identify the priorities at those particular times in our lives, those seasons that we're going through. How do we prioritize those things and still be able to accomplish everything that we want to accomplish? And sometimes we can't. So as a generally a traditional soldier, I went from essentially 1991 all the way to 2004, and I didn't spend any extended time on active duty. Traditional National Guard soldier. There was always this pull. I worked for as an IT guy. I had a company. And then I went to work for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department as a senior network systems analyst. And I worked there doing things. So there's always this competition for your time. And then I got married, and there's competition for your time. How do I start balancing? And I'll tell you, it is one of the most difficult things that you can ever do, because somebody is always going to feel neglected. The Army feels neglected. And this guy is, you know, he's not living up to his potential. That's always the one I love. Not living up to his full potential. I don't have time to show you that. I don't have the opportunity necessarily to show you that. Or at work, well, he's always off doing Army stuff, you know, because I have this commitment over here, and that becomes a struggle. And then in the middle of all of that, you have a family, and your family's like, hello, like you come home And I would come home from work, from working at whichever job Metro will say at the time, and then I'm doing Army stuff, and I'm working on Army stuff because I'm preparing things for whatever was going on that weekend, or maybe even months out. I'm preparing things, or I've got a meeting, a training meeting that I need to attend. There's always something else to do when you're leading soldiers, so it becomes a difficult proposition. I would suggest for most of our reserve component soldiers is not just about the money, although money makes it more palatable, you know, being paid for that time. But I've had soldiers that traveled across country from South Carolina out to Las Vegas to attend drill. I had a command sergeant major who was working in D.C. as a federal air marshal at the Fusion Center, who was flying out to Las Vegas for drill. So a lot of times you'll see Reserve and National Guard soldiers are actually giving money, paying money for this opportunity to show up, to be a soldier, to be a part of this bigger thing. And I don't think they always get the recognition that they deserve for that level of commitment. They're committed. And maybe they don't have all the opportunities to show the potential. Maybe they don't have all the opportunities to be the greatest whiz-whammo soldier that there ever was. But they certainly do make up for that in spades with this level of commitment and level of pride in getting to the place that they need to go conduct that training. Mm. And it is a tough balance for us. Over the years, I've seen some people do it better than others, but like Compo One, I've seen divorce when those things are not supporting each other, mm-hmm. or some priority is maybe out of whack. So I think it can be a bit of a difficult proposition with this stool. Any one of those gets pulled out from underneath you, you lose your balance and you're going to end up flat on your face or flat on your butt.
Good. Does that tie in with H2F? What you said you've just finished doing something with H2F before you came here to talk to us. Are they tied together? I mean, how would you tie them together?
Well, I think there's certainly a lot of things that we're talking about in H2F with you know the five pillars and especially as leaders, how do we better take care of ourselves? And that's really what we're doing here at the School for Command Prep and this H2F day that we spend really helping leaders to see themselves in this holistic health and fitness lens. How do they better themselves? Because, you know, let's face it, we spend all this time. We're going absolutely crazy throughout the day. It's you know, I've got Army this, and we're in there at waking up at 04, go do some PT, get into the office by 06, start prepping things for the day, you know, a first formation somewhere in there, or meetings start, and then we rush out to all the meetings, and we're doing all these meetings all throughout the day, and then finally we show up about, you know, 1700 or so, and hey, we got all these emails that we got to answer, and I can answer the mail on this, and I got to prep this paper for that, and I got to get this IP for this person. And by the time you're done with even some of that, now it's 8 o'clock, you're going back home to your family who's now already in bed to get up the next day and do the same thing over again. And funny enough, we call those key development positions, and we develop people to burn themselves out. Back to where I was fortunate, as I reached those burnout points, I was able to voluntarily stop. I don't have to stay on that train the way that our Compo One folks do. There's a constant churn that just goes on as you promote. Mm-hmm. And we do it willingly. And believe me, I don't say any of those folks are crazy. They're incredible, incredible leaders with incredible dedication to the organization. But as we talk about this holistic health and fitness and balancing the five pillars, how do I balance this mental or emotional pillar over here? How do I balance that with getting my fitness or, you know, spiritual fitness? How does my family play into all of this? And how do I, now all of a sudden I'm carving out time, I'm scheduling time to be with my family as opposed to just every evening I come home and I get to go play with my kids and, you know, we're going to play some ball and whatever. I mean, if I got to go to the field, hey, we're out in the field this week, no problem. But when that's every week, every day, and you're having to go into the office on weekends and go do things on weekends, and there is no time, or you, even worse, you bring your work home with you to sit at home to get all the work done because everything has to get done. I think it creates a lot of struggles for our soldiers today. So what we're trying to do with H2F there at School for Command Prep is really show them how to balance that sleep hygiene, if you will. How do you balance this whole life? How do you put these things into some level of priority so that you can see yourself a little bit better and really the things that you need, the things that you're hungry for, taking care of your family, taking care of friendships, the things that you need to sustain, because at the end of this, every single one of us has an expiration date. Mm-hmm. There's a day that we are going to retire. That'll be the last day that we put on that uniform and we salute the flag and we're going to move on. That day is going to come. But in between the start and the finish to all of that, how are we going to define success? Is that just the number of medals and ribbons and stuff like that I have? Is it the number of people's lives that I've been able to positively impact? Is it that I was able to raise a family and accomplish mission? How do we measure those things? How do we look back on our life and be fulfilled in what we did? So I think H2F really helps you to reflect back on those things that are important for you. And everybody's going to be a little different. What are those things that are important for you? And how do you reprioritize your life so that you can better meet those needs?
You know, because a lot of people that put that stuff on you, like you need to go to college, you need to get better at shooting, you need to go to this training. But you're talking about how your personal things are some of the things that you need to maybe focus time on. because that is what's actually ultimately going to help you the most. I guess so you're more prepared for those times you have to go train.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. And I would also suggest, and we can see this across management and civilian jobs that I've had, when you as a leader invest that time into your people or give them the opportunity, make sure that they have the time to prioritize their family. When they do come back, they're better prepared to mm-hmm. give more, right? If every day you show up to work and give 100%, what do you have left for your family when you get home?
Exactly.
And that answer, if you gave 100%, then is zero. You have zero to come back to your family, and that's not right. So this notion of we have to show up every day and give 100%, and then we go home, we're completely drained, mentally drained, emotionally drained. You know, that one knucklehead that was in our formation, man, why couldn't he just get it? Why was she doing this?
Yeah.
Whatever, man. It takes its toll on you. A little, a lot, it doesn't matter. But if you're given that 100% at the job, you go home, you have zero left in that tank. And now you spend more time sitting in front of TV trying to recharge your batteries, trying to get something back. And then, hey, I'm going to recharge my batteries. Get this. So the next day I can go do it all over again and show up and give 100%. And that's the Army, our country deserves the absolute best that you have to give. There's no two ways about that. We put this uniform on, we gave a commitment to give the best to our country. It is selfless service. So I completely understand that, and I appreciate that. I love that. People still join and they have that same spirit of selfless service, of nothing but respect for those folks. But we also have to make sure as leaders that over time they learn how to balance within their lives. And we need to give them that space so that when they do come back to us, when they have the opportunity to give 100%, we get 100%. And what's funny is sometimes what they think their 100% is really is what they would have considered 150%, right? They just gave so much more. Mm-hmm. They showed up and gave and get, man, and they just keep going, and they loved doing it because they know on the back end, you're going to make sure that they get back to their family safe. They know that somebody is taking care of them.
Well, I think it goes to expectations. It's hard on a soldier, just a person in general, you know, and you join the Army, which if you have to give 100% there because the enemy's not going to care, like, you know, that you had your family time today, you know, they're not going to care if you're not prepared or whatever, what have you. So, but in garrison day-to-day life, you know, the Army wants your 100%, your leaders, every leader you talk to, you know. Hey, how can I help you? You know, what can I do to make this mission more successful? And then you get home and your wife wants 100%, you know, and then you see your kids, if you have them, they want 100%. They want dad or mom. So, but then you go on deployment and now you have to essentially try and call every day, you know, if you can, because they're going to expect it. It's all about expectations, I think. And sometimes that's very difficult in the Army to fulfill. And sometimes, like you said, balancing those, one will fall over, and you just got to try not let that happen.
Sure. And I would also caution you, though, on expectations, right? Sometimes we develop these expectations in our mind of what we think somebody else expects of us, and that's not really what they expect. There have been a lot of times that my wife has told me, like, well, why don't you go work out? No, because I need to spend time and spend enough time here. She's like, no. Go work out, all right, get out of the house. So we create sometimes these expectations like, hey, we're supposed to be there and I'm in the place that I'm supposed to be. But if you're physically there, but not emotionally there, then you're not in the right place. And I think fortunately I'm blessed. My wife totally understands that. And she would tell me that my triathlon was so great. She's like, you need to go for a run. She tells it to my son all the time. You need to go for a run. I love being there with my family. I love my girls climbing into my lap and hugging them and all of that. But I think my wife recognizes that I also need to put into me. So I would suggest that it's also communication and being open and honest about really what it is that you need. And maybe next week you have more time at home because this week you put a little bit of time into yourself. And the week after that, maybe there's more time for the Army because you feel better, your family feels better, and now Army gets a little more.
Yeah, like you said, it's you have to find the right balance for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of moving in a little bit different direction. I was very curious because you, in your bio, it says you were the Nevada State Command Senior Enlisted Leader. I was wondering kind of what that is and what are some of the, maybe some of the things that the National Guard, because you would know, is assigned or tasked to do. And then do you have maybe a specific example of something that that you had to go through as in that position?
Yeah, well, I think you're the first guest that we've had who's actually been in the National Guard.
Sure,
we might have had authors for some of our articles, but I think it's a subject or a group of individuals in the Army that I think get neglected or passed over or you know for some reason or another. But yeah, it would be great if you could tell us about that.
Of course, the Command Senior Enlisted Leader for any one of our states is the most senior non-commissioned officer in the state and works directly for the Adjutant General. So real quick kind of history, U.S. Code Title 32 then is the authority that that has these folks, if you will, in place. And that's a little bit different than U.S. Code Title 10 that all of our Compo 1 and Compo 3 folks generally fall under is Title 10 authorities. We fall under Title 32 authorities. So that means that my Adjutant General, my boss at the time, works directly for the governor of that state. In almost all instances, we have 50 states, of course, three territories, and the District of Columbia. D.C. is a little bit different, but we'll lump them in. They have a commanding general who technically works for the president, but authorities are delegated to the Secretary of the Army, and that just gets into a whole convoluted space with D.C. Guard. It's kind of interesting. But for the other 53 states' territories, the Adjutant General, most senior officer in that state, generally a two-star, at the very least, it's a two-star billet. So the Command Senior Enlisted Leader is responsible for both the Army and the Air National Guard. So I had the opportunity to really delve into a joint billet that is kind of highlighted in JP 3-33. That's where we talk about the Command Senior Enlisted Leader. In work across two different services. Now, I learned a whole heck of a lot. I thought I really knew Army pretty well, and I did reasonably well. But looking at it from now a joint perspective, what are some of the things that my Air counterparts did that we can really do in the Army that were easy? And what are some of the things that we do in the Army that I can share with the Air counterparts? So I found this job really as more of like a conduit of information. Now, I had a couple of incredible state command chief master sergeants that I worked with. I had an incredible state command sergeant major that I worked with on the Army side. And we were able to make changes to the culture. That was really the goal, make changes to the culture of our state that we really wanted to. And that had a lot to do with behaviors, the look, feel of the state, if you will, some of the toxic things that had been taking place, unbeknownst to me. We were able to really start off-ramping, I think, some of those things. At the very least, we worked our butts off to get to that end. But we took it really as a joint nature. Instead of saying, okay, Air is going to do that over there and we'll do Army stuff over here, we started doing some joint things where we could, where they made sense. In one of the instances, we had an exercise where we had our security forces on the air side within our wing working with military police on the Army side, and we brought in rotary wing assets to move them around, and we had, because they in the wing there they only have non-tactical vehicles, pickup trucks and things like that, because generally it's going to be around the wing, except that they need to be expeditionary, so they also need to be able to use Humvees at the time and stuff, MRAPs and things like that. So we have those with the Army. So we're able to start doing some cross training, and it was just being a conduit and going, hey, well, have you looked at this, or how do we do that? And I learned a lot. I then took took some of that experience with me to the Pentagon, and I think it paid some dividends while I worked up there. But I think some of the tasks that we have in the Guard, you know, you see today we've got, you know, North Carolina, Tennessee, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, all of those states, and then several supporting states that have assets and resources that are working to do disaster relief from Hurricane Helene. And of course, we have another hurricane that's getting ready to push through, or I suppose is pushing through.
I think it's tonight.
Right now, yeah. Is fixing to push through Florida. You know, for Florida, I'll tell you, Florida, Louisiana, a lot of those Gulf states, incredibly, incredibly well-versed at doing these things. They are hands down the subject matter experts when it comes to how do we do disaster relief operations? How do we do DISCA, defense support to civilian agencies? How do we do those DISCA missions? They've got this stuff on absolute lockdown. Great team of professionals. Texas, you know, as well, these things become like just a battle drill. We're going to do these over and over and over again. But I'd also say that, you know, all of those things over and over, they start to take a toll maybe on your readiness for going and doing our primary mission, which is to fight one of our nation's wars. So again, we go back to balancing units, where units are within cycles and all of that stuff. So we can get the right resources, the right place at the right time. And I think the leaders across those states, those command senior enlisted leaders, those adjutants general, they do an incredibly bang up job of having to the adjutants general make those decisions, who's going to go where. And then for the command senior enlisted leaders, really providing that feedback, who are some of the best units, who's morale and things like that with the people to get out there and accomplish those missions.
And then I would ask, as Nevada CSEL, what was like your biggest challenge?
Yeah, but I think probably the biggest challenge that I had was enabling effective communication. When you want to change the culture of any organization, it doesn't just start with, hey, there's a good idea and everybody's going to love this. It usually starts with, we identified that we need to make some changes, and we identified why we needed to make those changes. And as we start working through making those changes, you end up having a lot of resistance because the way we've always done it is just real comfortable for people. But they'll cover that with, oh, this was so much more effective. Or, but we already know this and we can get this done very quickly. And that's not always doing things the right way. So I struggled, I think, to be able to effectively communicate everything that we needed to get changed and why. And to a certain extent, there was some salesmanship that really needed to take place there. So getting information down within a formation, I can go stand up in front of that formation and say, everybody, this is what I have to tell you. Open your ears, shut your mouths, and listen. And everybody kind of gives you the nod. That may go in one ear and out the other, but at least you can say, I have now provided everybody the information. As command senior enlisted leader for a state, geographically dispersed, I got, you know, about 15 hours from tip to tip in the state. I have units and people that are all in between. I only get to see them 1 week in a month, 2 weeks out of the year is what they are normally going to show up to make sure that they get this communication. Oh, and by the way, you know, the Army in the midst of all this took away their email addresses, cost savings. And there's a lot of really good reasons why these things had to happen, but it added a layer of challenge. And so fortunately now we've made up for that challenge again with you know, we've got email and some other things for them. But even that, you know, I get 1,001 emails on my personal email every day. Spam the heck out of that, right? How much am I actually looking at it and delving into, oh man, hey, you know, did Sergeant Major Spaulding send something to me today? We're just not. So I had to look at all of the different ways that I can communicate a message, leverage all of these different means to get a message to the people in the right way so that they would absorb it. So a buddy of mine, Mario Torinas, was using Instagram, and I'm watching his Instagram stuff, and he is doing all these reels on there, and I am laughing, but his followers go up, but more importantly, he has penetration across his formation up there at Fort Drum, and I would suggest even down at the time Fort Polk, right? He had penetration across all of 10th Mountain, and he was able to be with people even though he wasn't physically with them. And so I wanted to kind of model some of those things. I wanted to use, man, this guy's got some good lessons learned. How do I do that? And we started with some Facebook Live stuff, and I wanted to get more into doing YouTube videos and all these other things. And it just so happens in the midst of all this, here's COVID.
Yep.
So now I don't even get to go and see people. Everybody's holed up in their homes. You don't really get to be around people. Yep. That trying to communicate with people when they don't have to communicate with me. They don't have to listen. They're on their own. They're Joe Civilian today. It was a struggle. Heck, sometimes I couldn't even get my fellow command sergeants major or those chief master sergeants to want to listen. So it was my problem to solve, not theirs. I had to make them want to listen. I had to help to inspire them to get to that place. And I don't know that I was always successful, but I think by the time I left the job, I had a little bit better penetration than when I started.
Sergeant Major Spaulding, it's been our pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for more interesting guests and inspiring conversations right here at the NCO Journal. Submit your articles, get published. Don't forget to visit our webpage and follow us on our social media. We'll see you next time on the Sergeant's Time Podcast.